going to start with a question. How many people here grow food? It could be herbs, tomatoes, root vegetables, fruits, nuts, by show of hands. Okay, so quite a few. How many people make their own bread, cheese, beer, soda, anything like that? Less. And so why do you grow that food? Is it reducing costs, saving money, generating money? Is it seen as a pastime or a hobby? Is it something about reconnecting with nature? Is it about freshness, taste, quality? So in terms of, in the back there, do you mean, why do you do?
It's just a hobby.
Okay.
It makes me relaxed.
Okay. Patrick, I saw your hand was up. Why do you do it?
Quality.
Okay.
Good quality.
Someone else? Anyone else want to volunteer an answer? Okay, so I study and participate in local food movements, particularly in my dissertations on food justice and food sovereignty movements in the United States, and connecting them to the global food sovereignty, food justice movements. So today I'm going to be focusing a lot on urban agriculture, particularly in New York City, but then also connecting it to a larger national movement and how it connects to social reproduction and new politics of work. So when I'm looking at local food production, I'm particularly interested in how is land and labor obtained? Is it monetized? Is it marketed? Is it withdrawn from the market through land trusts? Is that done through private means? Is it tied to the state? Like in terms of, do you talk to the Department of Parks and Recreation, a city entity, to try and protect that land long-term so it's institutionalized that way? And if you're producing food, how are you distributing it? Are you gifting it away? And who are you gifting it to? Is it friends and family? Or are you doing it to food shelters, pantries, those types of things? Is it for self-consumption? Are you selling it on the market? What's going on with that income? Are you just like saying, communalizing it in terms of reinvesting it in your own individual plot or community plots? And if you are keeping it for yourself, are you paying rent bills with that? Are you buying other types of food at the items? So in terms of, and so in terms of, I'm kind of looking at those reproduction models. And so I had a PowerPoint, but you really can't tell, so see it that well. So maybe later on we'll look at a graph or two. In the history of the US and in the last couple of decades, there tends to be kind of a hegemonic local or alternative food movement which prioritizes saving small farmers, environmental sustainability, and the new hot one now is anti-obesity politics, so a politics of health. And historically, that tends to privilege consumption politics, individualism. It's very much oriented to agrarian centrism and tends to tie back to conceptions of Jeffersonian democracy. This tends to mythologize the small farmer as central to democracy. The most kind of recent and egregious example of this is the White House Garden. I'm sure everyone knows about the White House Garden, which tends to be kind of the central focus of like healthy green discourse, where this becomes the kind of the new component of the hegemonic local food movement, where local food spaces are seen as central to fitness and health. And I contend in doing so, it tends to marginalize other attempts of reading and framing those movements, and therefore fails to understand why local food movements may not be prioritizing health or fitness, or why those may be components of that, but there's other more important issues at stake. And so like the White House Garden, and for particularly strategic regions, tends to cleanse the social conflict between jobless growth, the profit motive, poverty, race, and class privilege, famine, corporate monopolization, increasing inequality, concentrated property ownership. So in that sense, and having spent quite a time listening to people talk in lines at like Target, Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and just going to farmers markets and stuff, you tend to see what people talk about when they talk about local food. And so in that sense, the White House Garden tends to represent this movement where the space is presented to an extent as raceless and classless. Anyone can do it, and therefore everyone is doing it to be healthy and green. And so this becomes a new signifier of citizenship and belonging, and in that sense ties back to World War I and World War II, where it was a lot about victory gardens, it was a lot about nationalism and citizenship. Today, we're no longer fighting a war against the evil Germans, we're fighting a war against obesity. And so the discourse and the rhetoric and the practices tend to have certain historical linkages. And obviously, to a certain extent, this is tied to both who's writing on the food movement, but also, therefore, who controls the funding streams. If you look at a lot of the funding streams in the alternative food movement, historically, it's about sustainability, environmental politics, saving small farmers. It's not about issues of social reproduction, particularly in terms of issues of livelihood, income generation, providing food to individuals who may not have enough income to obtain food to the market. And so obviously the food justice and food sovereignty movement is very hot right now, and it's very burgeoning. And that, to some extent, is connected with a longer issue in terms of neoliberalization globally in the U.S., but also in the past couple of years, the local food movement, particularly in New York, really, really got big around the turn of the economic crisis. I mean, it had roots there, particularly in the 70s. But now, if you spend any time in Bushwick or Bed-Stuy or Prospect Heights or East New York, there's local food production popping up anywhere. Windowsills, rooftops, community gardens, empty lots. And so one of the key things here is that what I'm doing in my work and what I'm gleaning from talking to individuals is that this hegemonic local food movement, when I'm talking about, marginalizes and kind of does not necessarily understand theoretically what's going on. Because by saying, oh, people are growing it because they want to be green and healthy and those types of things, actually a lot of food production is going on because there's a lack of alternative economic opportunities. The failure of the wage to cover the cost of social reproduction. There's a lack of neighborhood places to procure fresh food at affordable prices. Having spent time in East New York, I can say that's definitely true. And also another thing that becomes important is that, you know, there's significant numbers globally, but also in the U.S., of land-based peoples who historically have done and reproduced themselves through food, where food is central. And that doesn't get encapsulated within this new politics of health. And so in that sense, these spaces are strategic spaces of social reproduction, and that's why I asked, why do people engage in these practices? Because for many individuals, monetized food goods are being replaced with subsistence practices that allows that income to be used for different purposes. Where food is produced because one can't afford monetized food goods, with that income, also you can monetize the food goods that you're producing, and that can help pay for livelihood costs at both the individual, the household, and the community level. I'm looking at how are those related, because a lot of new food groups are nonprofit groups, not just community gardening groups at a block level. And so in that sense, obviously food grown organically under oppressive working conditions on the farm, say in Long Island, food grown leisurely at the White House is indeed local food, but the local food being grown in Oakland, LA, Detroit, Milwaukee, New York, Philadelphia, up in Holyoke at Nueces Races, and by indigenous peoples in Minnesota, Wisconsin, New York, Arizona, and Oregon, those are all for different reasons. It's largely about politics of social production and the politics of work. Because food sovereignty in the U.S. tends to be tied to two groups who use it discursively. One, small farmers are using it, but the other dominant group is the indigenous. And so if you go to indigenous reservations today, there's a lot of attempts to regain traditional subsistence food practices, particularly in terms of Minnesota, Wisconsin, a little bit in upstate New York, and Arizona. And in Oregon and Washington, it takes the form not necessarily of direct agricultural production in terms of food, but the issues on politics over fish and salmon. And so what's interesting, just a little quick aside, is because of historical treaties that can be made, indigenous groups can force the state and polluters to clean up the waterways because they have subsistence rights. And so it's an interesting legal manifestation of treaties, which is historically new in the U.S., and tied a lot to the environmental justice movements. I mean, 100 years ago, we never would have thought to be able to use those types of treaty rights to force food production practices to be central. and to that in that sense to kind of decenter industrialization. And so one of the things here, and I had pictures and graphs, was a lot of the stuff that I find helpful to me comes from feminist geographers, political scientists, anthropologists, largely talking about the decentering of the iceberg economy, where all you have on the top is wage, labor, and capital, and you've got all this multiplicity of practices. A key thing is to remember there's a hierarchy within the multiplicity, so within volunteering, or gifting, or bartering, or worker cooperatives, all those types of different types of economic practices, it's important to recognize the hierarchy and how also they can be coupled. So one of the things I'm looking at is how people are coupling food production with self-employment with wage income. And so this, because this obviously has come internationally, the development institutes have realized that, hey, everyone can't be a wage laborer. And so now there's an attempt, how do we create self-employment, entrepreneurial activities internationally, but in fact, that's also coming back into the U.S. because since the 1970s, food production is very similar in terms of why people are doing it to globally, which is that wage labor is stagnated. It's not the future for a vast majority of people. It was never the reality of the majority of the human population. There's only, and we tend to be part of that, there's a small section that can survive fully on wage labor. There's another group that tends to combine wage labor with other types of entrepreneurial activities, and then there's a vast majority who combine subsistence production now with some types of self-employment entrepreneurial streams. And my contention is you're seeing that come back into the U.S., particularly in low-income areas that, and this becomes one of the key things in terms of why I'm framing this as a politics of work and social reproduction, is because these groups have historically been marginalized from and within the wage economy, which means they've always done multi-activity practices. It's not something new. The fact that, to a certain extent, it's becoming hot and new is because academia and other institutions have turned focus back on these populations. And so one of the key things here, then, is interrogating the larger development imaginary of modernity and wage labor in particular, you know, be it Marxist or capitalist, be it Keynesian or neoliberal, the whole focus on industrialization, urbanization, and wage labor as kind of like everyone moves to this. This is the linear trajectory. Obviously, one is historically accurate, but as a discourse, it's been extremely powerful in shaping. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? Okay. And so one of the key things is, I see a lot of similarities in terms of what Amy was talking about, particularly in terms of, I look at this in terms of also like framing it in terms of moral economy and those types of things, where particularly 1930s is how I frame it, wage labor became discursively, if not materially, hegemonic, particularly post-World War II. And that's falling apart for many reasons. And so at this time, looking at food justice and food sovereignty movements, it allows us really to theorize new politics of work and the technical and political recomposition of labor that's occurring. In the U.S., this largely takes a form of struggles over how do we remove land from the market? How do we change zoning practices? How do we reduce fees, regulations, all these stipulations where you can't grow food in your front yard, or if you try and sell it, you have to go through all these bureaucratic procedures at the state level. And so you see this, okay, I have 4 minutes. And so one of the things, a lot of questions I have in working through also is, because historically, multi-activity practices have been used, and that's typically been seen as, well, they're using that in terms of, like, once you combine wage labor to subsistence as an assumption of a move towards wage labor, as opposed to how communities have historically combined those practices strategically to maintain subsistence practices. I mean, you see that today. If anyone, there's a book recently called The New Peasantries, I believe, by Jan van Douwplug. It's fantastic and amazing. It's talking about re-peasantization and re-agrarianization globally. And he looks at Peru, he looks at Poland, I believe, and he looks at some other places. But it's a really good, theoretically dense, and historically rich manifestation. And my argument is you're seeing similar processes in the United States, too. And that, so like historically, the indigenous actually have long histories of using wage labor. within the 20th century and prior to the 20th century. And the wage labor was used either in terms of, in the Northwest, it was hops farming. They come down and do hops, and actually the hop seasons worked because they were tied in with the traditional migration patterns. In the Southwest, it was mining practices, and that wage income was used to a certain extent by necessities, but also maintain traditional practices. And so it's not just that wage labor is a mechanism of exploitation, but also to a certain extent can be strategically used, and that what this becomes one of the key questions now is how is food justice, sovereignty movements tied into this issue of the relationship between production and reproduction. So is city or state or federal facilitation of local food communities or economies or spaces seen as cheaper than traditional welfare state? So is this a mechanism of state devolution of power, which is, hey, we don't have to give you food stamps anymore because you can grow your own food? And so is this part of a shrinking of the state where it's seen as a new form of self-help and charity? Is urban ag seen as a temporary solution to countering hunger, poverty, and unemployment? Or is this a much longer viable model to wage labor? Is this about maintaining autonomy from wage labor and potentially state and capital? Because a lot of this has developed historically when state and capital left. I got a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. Does urban ag serve as a mechanism of green gentrification? In New York, that's a key issue, is in terms of once you start building up these spaces, hipsters, artists, they're involved in these processes in terms of they provide a lot of volunteer labor, but you tend to see a similar dynamic is, you know, Bushwick and Bed-Stuy, and it becomes a New Williamsburg, which, you know, New Williamsburg was the new Lower East Side at a certain point in time. And so this becomes a key issue as well. And does access to food production decrease wages, or at least the demand for higher wages, and thus allow capital to increase profits? I mean, historically in Appalachia, that's how it worked, where subsistence farming allowed cheaper wages for coal miners. Once the price and wage supports of the New Deal came in, basically you had massive automation of coal mining in Appalachia, and you had mass exodus there eventually. 30-second wrap-up. The reason I ask this is because there's typically been six waves of urban ag in the U.S. The first one, where is this? 1890s, massive depression there. Detroit, New York, and Philly, all from the state level, all top-down, are like, hey, we don't have a massive welfare state yet. Providing people land and tools to grow their own food is good because not the dole. It incentivizes individualism and the work ethic, but also we know it will occupy those spaces until the market and the state come back. You've got World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, all top-down. Those first four waves are all top-down. 1970s and today are much more bottom-up. So I'm trying to work out how is today connected to the bottom-up and the top-down. And I will stop, sorry.